All right, so I want to do something a little bit different tonight, kind of change things up a little bit. You guys are all pretty familiar with this text, I would imagine. Nathan confronting David concerning Bathsheba, concerning his adultery with Bathsheba, and the murder of Uriah the Hittite. So everybody's pretty familiar with this text. What I'd like us to do is, I gave you a text, I printed it off for you so you can make notes, and I put it double-spaced so that you can write things down, you can circle things, you can make whatever kind of notation you want, but there are some notes I want you to make, and then when we're done going through this, I'd like it, you guys to help me draw some conclusions, because what I want us to focus on are some pieces of repetition and some things that that help us stand out. And so maybe this will be, maybe this will help us all to become better students of the Bible. I know that this exercise was really useful to me in becoming a better student of the Bible. So we're going to work through it verse by verse, and I'm going to give you things that I want you to circle or maybe make a little highlight or take notes of things. And then we're going to go back through the text together, and we're going to draw some conclusions, okay? So this is out of the NIV. I actually have to say that it's out of the NIV, because if you ever look at the front flap of an NIV in the preface, they say that if you use their scripture in a sermon, you have to say that it's from the NIV. No one does that, but that's what they technically say you have to do. So pastors who are real sticklers will always put, like, parentheses NIV in their quotations, and if they quote it in the... their bulletins, because they don't want, you know, Zondervan to come and sue them or whatever. So I don't think Zondervan's going to do that, but anyways. So we come to the text tonight, and the Lord sent Nathan to David, and when he came to him, he said, there were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. Now, I want you to go ahead and make a note. I don't care how you want to do it. If you want to underline it, circle it, whatever, make a note. But that word rich is actually a word that's you guys all know in Hebrew. And it's straight out of Psalm 1. Does anybody know the beginning of Psalm 1 off the top of their head? Blessed is the man who does not... You guys, and that, now you guys know it, right? Well, in Hebrew, it really stands out. It's some Hebrew wordplay, and it's Ashrei ha'ish asher. Blessed is the man who does not, lo halach, who does not walk. Okay, so that is the word for blessed. So it isn't necessarily just a blessed man. This is an important word in David's theology. So Nathan comes to him and he says, hey, there's this man who's asher. He's rich. Okay, so go ahead and make some note that this word is blessed in Psalm 1. Okay, so that's something to note. And then the rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle. Now, you guys remember the parable, right? So, and if you haven't, you've read it. So, what's going on in the parable? Well, Nathan is confronting David with his own sin. So he comes to him with this parable, and he says, there were two men in a certain town, one who was very rich and one who was poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb that he had bought. He raised it, and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food and drank from his cup and even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Okay, so I want you to note if where it says he shared his food, circle that expression, shared his food, okay, and then slept in his arms. I want you to circle that. Now, these are going to be important terms later on, and you'll see why they're important in just a little bit. Okay, then the parable continues. Now a traveler came to the rich man. And this, by the way, this traveler thing, this is where a lot of preachers camp out on traveler. You know, they talk about how, like, the lust comes and goes in a person and it's a traveler and et cetera, et cetera. Okay, well, whatever. Maybe that's important, maybe it isn't. But he says it comes to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler. Okay, now, I want you to go ahead and make a note on that word refrained, okay? Refrained, make a note of that word, and then we continue, And he refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who had come to him. Instead, he took, underline took, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the man who had come to him. So what's the parable that Nathan has given David? What's the story? Can somebody summarize this for us? Yeah, just give us a brief summary of the story. Exactly. Right? So it's an act of theft, right? So it's theft. But is there any does the fact that the one man is rich, that the thief is rich, does that make it worse? This is not a trick question. I'm not trying to trick you. I want to know, does this make it worse in your eyes? Yeah, does it make it worse that the guy who steals the sheep has plenty of his own sheep? He has plenty of his own cattle. I mean, he picks the word blessed. There are words in Hebrew for rich. He could have picked that word, but he specifically chose a word that means blessed. Why did he choose the word that's blessed? Well, obviously, because he's saying that this guy isn't just, he's not just wealthy. He's been blessed by God. Now, to me, and I think to David at least, this makes it worse. Not only the abundance of the rich man who steals from the poor man, but the poor man's poverty and his affection for the little ewe lamb. Right? Like, this little ewe lamb probably was not being raised, you know, for meat. He was raising it because this ewe lamb, he was going to raise it for years and years and years, and the ewe was going to produce all of these, you know, baby lambs. Maybe this was this poor man's hope to have his own flock of sheep someday in the future. Right? So this is this guy's financial future, and the rich man just comes and takes it and uses this young lamb for a meal. I mean, this is a high-handed act of sin. And so what happens? Well, we come to verse 5, and David burned with anger against the man and said to Nathan, "As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this must die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity." Okay, now here's a really important statement, and we're going to see why this is really important later. But first of all, look at where it says this: the man who did this must die. Okay, I want you to make some kind of note, and over top of that, I want you to write this: the man is a son of death. That's the literal expression in Hebrew. The man is a son of death. Now, in Hebrew, to say the man is a son of death is an idiomatic expression which means the man must die, or he deserves death, or he should die for what he has done. But this is important. You're going to see why in a little bit. The man is a son of death. And then it says he must pay for that lamb four times over. Circle, make some kind of note for the word pay. All right, and over that, I want you to write Solomon. He must pay for that lamb four times over. Why must he do it? Why must he pay it for four times over? Well, again, circle this word because. We're going to see this word because again. Because he did such a thing and had no pity. Now, make a note of the word pity. Now, you go back up to verse 4. See the word refrained and the word pity? Connect those two words. Those two are the same word. The rich man had pity on his sheep, goats, cattle, but he did not have pity on the poor man. So David is, in his condemnation of the rich man, he's using some poetry. He's saying, look, this guy who had pity on his own cattle, he had no pity, right? And so David is the king, and David has spoken his judgment, okay? So now Nathan responds. Nathan comes back to him, and he says, you are the man. You're this man. You're the guy. He doesn't even say the rich man. He doesn't say you're the blessed man. He just says, you are the man. That's really interesting. There are two men in the story. There are two men. You're the man. Which man is he, Nathan? Which man is he? How do we know? Now, the NIV puts an exclamation point with this. They say, you are the man, exclamation point. That's how the NIV marks it. But we don't know which man he is. Why do we presume that he is the rich man? Why do we presume that Nathan is saying that David is the man who had this incredible act of cruelty? Why do we presume that? Well, because we know the backstory, right? We know what David has done. We know what David has done. We know that David has sinned. Okay? So then Nathan says that. Nathan continues in verse 7. He says, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I anointed you king over Israel. I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave your master's house to you and your master's wives into your arms. Circle that, into your arms. Okay? Circle that. And now draw a line all the way up to verse 3 where it says the lamb slept in his arms. It's the same word. It's the same word. Nathan is drawing these connections. He's saying, look, that little lamb that slept in the arms of the poor man, God took the women from Saul and now the women, and he gave them into your arms. He continues, I gave you all of Israel and Judah, and if this had been too little, I would have given you more. Why have you despised the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? Underline that, in his eyes. Why did you do what is evil in his eyes? You struck down Uriah. Underline struck down. And actually, I'll just say, over top of struck, I want you to write the word naka, N-A-K-A. N-A-K-A-H. Okay, naka. You don't need to pronounce it. You don't need to learn Hebrew tonight, but I just want you to know that that's the word that's used. You struck down Uriah the Hittite with a sword, and you took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Verse 9, you killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Actually, underline his wife too. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now therefore, because you have, the sword will never depart from your house because you despised me and took the wife, underline wife, of Uriah to the Hittite to be your own. That word because, right? That word because is a pretty rare word for the word because. Okay, it's not a common word in Hebrew. But this word because is the exact same word for because that David used when David pronounced the judgment on the rich man. Remember how I had you circle that one, that because up there? That's the same word. It's a rare word. That's the same word that Nathan has. Because Nathan is mirroring what he says to David off of what David has said and off of what he has previously told David. There's a connection. All of these portions of this text connect. So he's saying, now therefore the sword will never depart from your house. This is the judgment. Remember, look at the judgment that David gives. This is the judgment portion. Now remember, up until verse 10, what you're getting is a description from Nathan. You're not getting a judgment from Nathan. Nathan is saying, look, you're the man. This is what God says. I gave you this, that, and the other. What is he saying? I'm saying these are all the ways that I've blessed you. These are all the ways that you're asher. These are the ways that you're like the rich man. You were blessed by me to have and to possess all these things. And if that wasn't enough, what does he say in verse 8? If that wasn't enough, I would have given you even more. And then he asks the implicit question that's in the text from the parable, which is, why did the rich man not take one of his own sheep or cattle? Why did he show no pity on the poor man? We don't know. It's a silly question. Nathan says, why did you despise the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? And then he tells him, he clarifies the sin. You struck down the Uriah the Hittite with the sword, and you took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now comes the judgment. Look back in verses 5 and 6. What does David do? David describes the sin. He says, as surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die. But then he gives the judgment. He says he must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity. In verse 6, David pronounces the judgment. This lamb has to be repaid four times. What does Nathan do? He describes the crime and then he gives the judgment. Therefore, the sword will never depart from your house. Why? Because, same word that David uses in his legal judgment, because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own. Continuing in verse 11, this is what the Lord says. And this is now a description of the judgment that's coming. This is what the Lord says. Out of your own household, I'm going to bring calamity on you. Before your very eyes, I will take your wives and give them to one who is close to you. And he will sleep with your wives. I keep underlining the word wives here. He will sleep with your wives in broad daylight. You did it in secret. You did it in secret. But I will do this thing in broad daylight in all Israel. Notice again the word take. If you go back up to verse 11, I'm going to take your wives. I'm going to take your wives. So this idea of taking is really important here. The word wives keeps getting used. Okay, we're going to see why that's important in a little bit. So he's saying, I'm going to take your wives. I'm going to give them, and all of this is going to happen. And then he will sleep with your wives in broad daylight. The actual word for in broad daylight, the Hebrew expression, is in the eyes of the sun. So just over that, go ahead and make a note of that and just say, in the eyes of the sun. S-U-N, sun. Why are we taking note of that? Well, go back to what Nathan has already said about David and his sin. What did he do? He did what was evil in the Lord's eyes. And now, because he did what was evil in the Lord's eyes, God is going to punish him in the eyes of the sun. He's going to punish him before all of the people. You did it in secret, but this thing will be done before the eyes of the sun. This will be done before the eyes of all of Israel. So he's very clear. He says, this is what's going to happen. Verse 13, now David speaks again. David said, I have sinned against the Lord. David, we'll come back to this, but David doesn't give any excuse. He doesn't give any explanation. He just says, I have sinned against the Lord. Verse 13 continues, Nathan replied, the Lord has taken away some of your sin. You are not going to die. Now make a big block, make a star, make whatever you need to do to remember that word die. Because by doing this, you have shown utter contempt for the Lord, and the son born to you will die. Circle that whole last statement. The son born to you will die. Now, the son born to you will die. There's some space right next to that where the paragraph ends. How did David describe the man who, the rich man, who committed the high-handed sin? Do you remember the expression? I had you write it down. What were you going to say? He's the son of death. Who's going to die? Is David going to die? His son's going to die. David called himself. He says, the man who did this is a son of death. David gave his own judgment. He said, the man who did this deserves to die. The man who did this is a son of death. And what's going to happen? Now the son is going to die. There's deliberate wordplay going on. So the son will die because of the son of death. Or because the man is a son of death. Okay? There's more we could note there, but we're just gonna keep moving, okay? So verse 15, he says, after Nathan had gone home, the Lord struck the child. Circle struck. And I want you to write the word Yagaf. Y-A-G-A-F. Yagaf. You don't need to learn the Hebrew word. I just want you to notice it because we're going to talk about it in a little bit. The Lord struck the child that Uriah's wife, underline Uriah's wife, had borne to David. And he became ill. David pleaded with God for the child. He fasted, and he spent nights in sackcloth on the ground. The elders of his household stood beside him to get him up from the ground, but he refused, and he would not eat any food. Circle that, eat any food. He wouldn't eat any food. Let's go ahead and pause right here. He wouldn't eat any food with him. There's going to be one more mention of eating that goes on, and the eating is going to be mentioned after the child dies, and so, spoiler alert, the child does die. But these connections to eating, why do we have these mentions of eating? Why doesn't it just say that David fasted? I mean, the author could have said that David was fasting and they tried to get him to stop, but he continued to fast. It's a totally appropriate way to say it. Why is it phrased the way that it is, that he would not eat any food with them? Yes, absolutely. I think that's 100% correct. That's exactly the point I was going to make. The parable that Nathan gives is this parable about eating, about consuming. The traveler comes and the traveler needs a meal. And so the rich man doesn't provide the meal from his own provision. He takes the lamb that eats with the family of the poor man. And this idea of eating is really important, and I think you're right. Now, do you want to make a whole sermon out of this? No, I don't think there's enough to make a sermon out of here. But what we certainly hear is the author is building continuity. I color-coded my whole text for myself, my Hebrew text. And I color-code, and this is something I do if I'm ever working with a larger body of text, is I'll sit there and I'll take either words that are rare and I'll color-code them, or I'll take things that are heavily repeated and I'll highlight them, or I'll do them in a different color so that I can look back and visually for myself see. It's like, oh, wait a minute. There's a lot of purple here, or oh, like right up here, the word asher, the word for rich. That shows up in the first four verses. You never see it again. Now that's weird in a text like this. In a text where there's all this parallelism, you would at least expect blessed to show up in the other half, right? You would expect these terms that show up in the first part to show up in the second part, because that's what's going on, but it doesn't happen. It you don't see that. So, yes, thank you, Linda. I think that is exactly the right point. The author wants you to see continuity between this. He wants to remind you of why this whole thing happened. Now, is eating the sin? No, eating wasn't the sin. Eating was the sin in the parable. But the idea here is David is fasting. What's David doing now? What's fasting? Go ahead. It's not eating, right? But at a deeper level, what is fasting? It's probably an unfair question because you don't know what I'm looking for. But true or false, fasting is saying no to something good so that you can have something better. Is that a fair description of what fasting is? David couldn't control his own appetites. He could not control his sexual appetite, and that's what led to his adultery with Bathsheba. That's what led to him trying to get Uriah drunk to fool him into thinking that the child was his. That's what led him to murder Uriah with the sword of the Ammonites. Interestingly enough, he didn't die by the sword. He died by the bow. He was shot with arrows, but you know that's neither here nor there. I don't know if there's anything there. I haven't spent the time to study that. But David couldn't control his appetites. But now that judgment has been passed, what's David doing? He's taking control of his appetites again. Now he's fasting. Now he's doing the thing that he should have done before. That's basically what repentance is, right? Repentance is doing the thing now that you should have done before. So I'm not condemning David for this, but the author is trying to make the point here. The writer of 2 Samuel is making the point that when David sinned, it was because of a failure on his part to properly control his own appetites. Okay, maybe there is a sermon there. Anyways, there's a sermon everywhere if you try hard enough, or if you just make stuff up. Okay, so in verse 18, we continue. The seventh day the child died, underline died. David's attendants were afraid to tell him that the child was dead, underline dead. For they thought, while the child was still alive, he wouldn't listen to us when we spoke to him. How can we now tell him the child is dead, underline dead? He may do something desperate. That's a pretty good description. Like, obviously David's servants care about him, and they're making a point that seems reasonable, right? I mean, if you're talking to somebody who's clinically depressed, are you going to go and give them sudden bad news? You're probably going to try to avoid giving them the bad news, right? You're going to want to find a gentle way to break it to them. I mean, David has refused to sleep in his own bed. He's sleeping on the floor when he's sleeping. He's weeping. He's fasting. He refuses to eat. And now the child has died. Like, what is he going to do now? If that's how he acted when the child was alive, what's he going to do now that he's dead? And David, and by the way, notice how David behaves right here. And I know that this isn't the point of tonight's sermon, but look at what David does. David noticed that his attendants were whispering among themselves, and he realized the child was dead, underlined dead again. He says, is the child dead, underlined dead. He asked, yes, they replied, he is dead. Okay, so we've underlined dead every time it shows up here. But look at the way David responds to them. Now, I have a lot of criticism to give of David as a king, right? The Bible is very clear about David's flaws. He's a flawed man. But we also forget that David is an Oriental monarch. People, there's a reason why there's the saying, don't shoot the messenger. Because Oriental monarchs are not known for their kindness and compassion for their underlings and their lackeys. I mean, they were well known for being brutal and violent. David is not brutal and violent. David has a handful of moments in his life where he loses control of himself. David was also the tallest man in Israel and probably the greatest warrior in Israel, who was a warlord who fought for his own life for a long period of his life, where he was literally on the run for his life at every moment. And we can only pick apart 3 or 4 times in his life where David really failed. I'm not saying David is perfect. David had some big character flaws, but David's a pretty incredible person. The fact that David lived the life that he did and he still has this much compassion on the servants. And notice what the servants are afraid. The servants aren't afraid that David's going to kill us if we tell him the child is dead. They're saying, well, what is he going to do to himself? I don't know. I mean, you guys may differ with me on this, and that's totally okay if you do, but I think that this says something about who David is. David was plotting. Just in the previous chapter or two, David is plotting to murder Uriah. He's plotting to kill one of his servants. And here he's showing kindness to them, showing compassion on them. So David gets up off the ground in verse 20. And he got up off the ground, he washed, he put on lotions, changed his clothes. He went to the house of the Lord and he worshiped. Then he went to his own house and at his request they served him and he ate. Okay, again, he eats. When is he eating? Now here's the interesting thing. When David commanded Bathsheba to be brought to him, did anybody tell him no? Did anybody tell him no? Did anybody say, hey, Dave, like, she's not your wife, and she's Uriah's wife. You probably shouldn't do this. Did anybody say that to him? No. When David wanted to have Uriah killed, did David just, you know, slit his throat in a dark alley by himself and hide the body? No. What did he have to do? He had to have a lot of people involved in this. Joab had to know about it. You know, because Joab sent the army forward. And then all the other soldiers in the unit had to know what was going on. Because everybody else knows, hey, all of a sudden I want you guys to pull back and leave Uriah by himself. So there's an entire unit of soldiers who know that something's not quite right. There are a lot of people that know that something isn't quite right here. Did anybody tell David not to give in to his impulses? Did anybody tell David, don't give in to your appetite? No. When David wanted to wrongly indulge his appetite, no one came and stopped him. When he wanted to eat at the improper time, nobody had a problem with that. But now he comes home and he wants to eat at the proper time, and what do people do? Why are you acting this way? Wait a minute. No one had a problem with his behavior when he wants to sleep with one of his mighty men's wives. But now that he wants to eat after going to his son's funeral, now people have a problem with it. Again, I'm not trying to make a mountain out of a molehill, but I think there's something to notice that you know, a lot of people have this false notion, and you guys are all older than me. You guys all have more life experience than me. So if you think that I'm wrong here, please tell me. Okay, correct me. Disabuse me of my false notions. But I found in my own life that if I want to do something bad, very few people will come and tell me to stop doing that. Very rarely will someone have the courage to tell me, hey, you really shouldn't do that. More often than not, if you want to do something bad, you'll get people, you know, to give you the rah-rahs and cheer you on to do something bad. If you want to do something good, you're probably going to face opposition. This whole notion that, well, you know, I just, God's just given me a peace about it, and, you know, the Lord has opened the way, and I'm facing no resistance. Well, if you're facing no resistance, David faced no resistance before he slept with Bathsheba and murdered Uriah. No one resisted him. No resistance. Jonah had no problem getting on a boat to go to Tarshish when he went to Joppa. Nobody tried to stop him. He had no problem. He was down in and the storm is raging, by the way. When Jonah's down in the bottom of the boat, the storm is raging. They're throwing crap off the boat to try to save the ship. And what's Jonah doing? He's sleeping. Like, if you are determined to have a bad conscience, you can do it. Like, that, I'm you go girl. You can do it. You can sear your consciences with a hot iron. But anyways, I'm just... Am I wrong on this? You guys have lived longer than I have. Am I wrong? Yeah, but I think my assessment in life is that's the exception rather than the rule. Is you know, people coming and challenging other people. It does happen. I have a handful of friends that have done that for me. I don't say to me. They've done that for me when I've been clearly in the wrong, and I've respected them more for it, and I've thanked them for it. I think I always received it in the spirit that it was given, but anyways, yeah. So I'm working myself up into a lather here about this, but we must keep moving on here. We're almost done with the text, and then I want you guys to finish this sermon up for us, okay? So the end of 21, you know, when the child is dead, underline dead again. When the child now that the child's dead, you get up and eat. And David answered. He said, "While the child was still alive, I fasted and wept. I thought, who knows? Who knows? The Lord may be gracious." Circle the word gracious. "The Lord may be gracious to me and let the child live. But now that he is dead," underline dead, "why should I go on fasting? Can I bring him back again? I will go down to him, but he will not return to me." This is another place where, especially evangelical pastors like to camp out. Verse 24. "Then David comforted his wife Bathsheba." Circle that and put a bunch of stars around it. "And he went to her, and he made love to her, and she gave birth to a son, and they named him Solomon." Big marker on that one. Circle, star, circle, star, circle, star, whatever you have to do. "The Lord loved him, and because the Lord loved him, he sent word to Nathan the prophet to name him Jedidiah." Jedidiah, so. So we have this text. Now, why did I have you circle? Let's kind of work backwards here. And then we're going to work backwards, and I'm going to give you two things that I noticed, and then I'm going to ask you guys to answer two questions for me, okay? So if you notice Bathsheba, I had you circle and star that. If you were to go back through the text and circle, and you were to look at every time I had you underline the word wives, you see the word wives quite a few times. Wife and wives is there a lot. It's an important thing in this text, right? Nathan tells David, you know, "I gave your master's wives to you. I gave your master's wives into your arms. And you did this." And the word wife and wives is used over and over and over again, but never the name Bathsheba. Her name does not appear until verse 24, the epilogue of this little section. Now, why is that? I'll just throw that out. Why do you guys think that is? Why do we not get her name until the end? Who is Bathsheba before this verse? What is she called? Yeah. Before this, she's called the wife of Uriah the Hittite. She's not called David's wife before this. Why is she called David's wife now? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm... No, that's exactly what I'm after. Yeah, it's... Uriah's dead. She's not Uriah's wife anymore. I don't know where to go with this. I mean, there are a couple different directions you could go, but I mean, there's something very interesting about the text that she's not even called Bathsheba. She doesn't even have a name before this. That's what was that? Oh, okay. I bet you're right. Anyways, so she's not even called by her name before this. She's just Uriah. She's the wife of Uriah. Now, I don't know what to do with this. There's, you know, any theory that I put out is going to probably be more complicated than is warranted. But something is happening. David is now in control of himself again. David is back. He is in control of his appetites. He's in control of his desires. And the woman who before was another man's wife, she was just, the word for woman and wife in Hebrew is the same word. It's Isha, woman, wife. Before she was just a woman. Now she has a name. Now she's not just another man's woman. Now she's her own person. There's something that happens to Bathsheba on the way to the story. And this has nothing to do with Bathsheba as a person, because most scholarship out there presumes that what David did was closer to a rape than adultery. You know, you can draw your own conclusions on that. But before, Bathsheba is an object of David's lust. Now she's her own person. She's her own person now. So I think that's worth considering. We don't have too much longer, so I'm going to ask you the next thought, and then we'll close. If you go back, I had you write down two Hebrew words. I don't know if you guys remember what they were, but they're both on the second. They're on the second page. Yeah, Nakah and Yagaf. Nakah and Yagaf. I had you write these down, and here's what I want you to. I want to ask you guys, and I'm sincerely asking you. Over and over and over throughout this text, we see parallelism, right? We see the same words being repeated. And what do we see? We see divine justice. David strikes down Uriah. Wouldn't we expect God to strike down the child in vengeance and justice? We would, right? We would expect the word that talks about how God strikes the child to be the same word. But it's not the same word. Why is that? I really do want to know your opinion on that. If we're getting the same word to create parallelism all throughout the text, even when it doesn't always make sense, even if it's not the perfect word, why do we get a different word here? I think that's kind of the way I was going to go with it. Actually, that's kind of the theory that I had, is when David struck down Uriah, I think that the author wants to make a point, a subtle point, but he wants to make a point that when God enacts judgment, he doesn't behave as men do when men are after their own desires. The child is going to die. This is the judgment that God has given, is that the son has to die because the father is a man of death, or is a son of death. Right, there's a whole gospel presentation right there. But he has to die. But the way God strikes him is not going to be the same way that David struck Uriah. Thank you, Jim. I think that's awesome. Thank you. You made it really easy for me. I was hoping that everybody would get that, and you guys got it right away. So thank you. The last thought. Well, actually, the same thing happens, by the way, with the word gracious. where it says, where David says, who knows, the Lord may be gracious to me and let the child live. Now, you would expect that word to be what? You would expect that word to be the word have pity, to spare, like that we've seen already. Remember how we have that those two words that I asked you to circle, where it says in verse 4, the rich man refrained, the rich man spared his own sheep. And then when David curses, he says, because he did such a thing in verse 6, he did such a thing and had no pity. Wouldn't we expect David, when he's explaining himself, to say, maybe the Lord will have pity and let the child live? You'd expect him to say that, right? Because we would expect the parallelism from David's own words to be matched through here. But it's not. It's a different word. Again, I think there's something deliberate happening there, similar to what Jim said, where the way the Lord shows pity, the way the Lord is gracious, is different from the way human men are. The last thought I have for you, and this is just a little theory. If you guys think it's a garbage theory, let me know. But I had you put Solomon over the word, he must pay for that lamb four times over. It's because the Hebrew verb is shalom, you know, like the word shalom, shalom, shalom. Shalom means peace. Shalom means to kind of to put things in order, right? So the idea of peace in the Hebrew mindset isn't just an absence of war. It's everything being in their right place, everything being in their correct order. Everything is the way that it should be. That's the idea of shalom, the idea of peace, that everything is right. And so that's why this word for repayment, this is a common use of the verb in Hebrew, is that he has to repay. He has to set things right four times over. So he has to repay. He has to shalom four times over. And then what does he name his son? Shlomo. He has to shalom. He names his son Shlomo. Is that an accident? What do you guys think? Is that just coincidence? Is that accidental? Dan's saying, I don't know, maybe. I don't know. Gene, what do you think? Is that, huh? It's for a purpose. Okay. So what's the purpose? And I'm sorry for just pushing right back at you, but what's the purpose? Yeah, I think that there are two ways we can look at that. And I think that is the positive way. That, I mean, David didn't know what was going to happen. Did he think he was not going to be able to have any more kids? Did he think that Bathsheba would be barren? I mean, remember, 1 Samuel, 1 and 2 Samuel, all kinds of women are turning up barren because of their sin. Right? Like barrenness is a big theme in 1 and 2 Samuel. So does he think that Bathsheba is going to be barren, that maybe he'll be sterile? Probably. He's probably afraid of that. But now he comes back to the wife, and who is she now? She's not Uriah's wife anymore. She's his wife now. She has a name now, and he sleeps with her, and she bears a son. The generous way of looking at this is, maybe what David is saying is, things have been put right between me and God. That's what you suggested, Gene. Things are made right. At least between Bathsheba and I and God, we can move forwards in peace. There has been forgiveness. The atonement that when Nathan said that God has already forgiven your sin, that was real. The forgiveness was real. Now that's the generous way of looking at it. There's a less generous way. The less generous way of looking at that is, David might be thinking, maybe God won't follow through with it. Maybe I won't have to pay four times over. Remember? What did he say? This man has to pay four times over for what he did? Maybe David's thinking, maybe I won't have to pay four times. Except what happens? That child dies. The unnamed child dies. Amnon rapes Tamar, and Absalom murders him. Absalom dies by Joab's hand in the rebellion. We'll talk about that Sunday. And then Adonijah is killed by Solomon when Adonijah tries to kill Solomon and steal the throne. David will lose 4 sons. David here may be hoping that atonement has been made, that he will not have to pay 4 times over. But he does. We don't know that yet, but he does. And so, you know, that there are all sorts of ways to look at that, because maybe what you could ask yourself is, when we look at the text going forwards, is ask yourself the question, if David had behaved differently, would he have lost 4 sons? I mean, I know that that's an impossible question, but if David had acted differently, would he have had 4 sons die? I don't know that he would have. That's something we could talk about, though, in the future. But I have taken you guys 6 minutes past, and it has been all me talking tonight, so I thank you very much for your patience and your listening. And yeah.